Thanks, Maggie, and welcome everybody. We're going to have a real treat today because I want to share with you all a discovery I made, although some of you may have made it too. A couple of years ago, I found out that in one of our states, in over 250 small towns mostly and smaller cities, that there had developed organizations of people whose insight was that there was a lot of wealth and that that wealth could be identified and invested in ways that would shape the future and define the community's possibilities. It was a movement that has spread so far that I could hardly believe it. So today, we're joined by Jeff Yost, who is one of the people at the center of getting this initiative started. And so Jeff, welcome. And I wonder if you could let us know a little bit how what was the antecedent to your focusing on local wealth. I know there was a study that got you started. Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, John and Peter, thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting the Nebraska Community Foundation to be a part of this conversation. We're certainly honored to do that, and asset-based community development and all of the terrific work that is explored within your Abundant Community book. These have been undergirding principles of our work for the last 20 years. So it's just an honor to be here. Thanks. The Nebraska Community Foundation got started 20 years ago. We're just celebrating our 20th anniversary with the whole idea that in so many ways, communities had changed and communities really didn't have the same, you know, type of discretion that they had had previously. And certainly within the context of Nebraska in particular, that we needed to find different ways to have a more positive narrative about the future, a more positive conversation with, you know, between parents and their kids over the kitchen table and between adults and youth in communities. To try to attract that next generation to wanting to be a part of all of this work. So much of the underpinning for this work started with the tremendous outmigration that we've seen over the decades in many, many rural places throughout Nebraska and throughout the northern Great Plains. And how do you help create even greater pride in place, and how do you help people to craft a narrative where they're really talking in positive, opportunistic terms about the future of their place. So this has really been a work in progress over time, but one of the pieces we started with is in many places around the country, community foundations had gotten started, and we're certainly interested in the whole idea of how do you use local charitable giving as one more tool within that community development puzzle. And I think we've certainly found that it's even more powerful than we thought it might be. I want to start with how we define the Nebraska Community Foundation. And we always talk about the Nebraska Community Foundation being a community development institution that uses philanthropy as a tool. We're not a charity. We're not in the business of doing things for people. We're in the business of figuring out how can we be a value-added partner to community leaders to help them build the community of their dreams. So a few years into this work, there was a study done at Boston College called Millionaires in the Millennium. And Paul Sharavish and John Havens really explored this whole intergenerational transfer of wealth and the magnitude of that. Well, if you're in a place like Nebraska and a lot of the next generation had in fact migrated someplace else, you know, not only was the population of many of these places shrinking, but the demographics of these places were aging because the people that were leaving were, of course, younger people and people early in their careers. So it's not a very long walk to figure out if there's this massive transfer of wealth that's happening between generations, if the next generation doesn't, in fact, inhabit that same place, then not only are you losing all of that human resource capacity if the next generation doesn't return to that community and live and work there, you're potentially going to lose all of that or much of that extraordinary financial wealth that's been built up, especially since World War II. So over the years, we've done a few of these transfer of wealth studies, and I just want to be very respectful of time today, but so we can go into it in some deeper history if people wanted to within questions. But we always knew the transfer of wealth is huge. But I'm an economist by training, and I honestly didn't have any clue that it was going to be of this magnitude. Nebraska is about 1.8 million people. It's a very large geography. There's actually 532 communities within the state of Nebraska. And it's about 500 miles from end to end if you go from northwest to southeast. For those 1.8 million people in that reasonably large geographical area, our estimate, and we think this is reasonably conservative, is some $600 billion will transfer from one generation to the next 50 years.
That's billion.
Billion.
Yeah, well.
Those are staggering sums. And a longtime colleague of mine, a gentleman that is a co-director of something called the Center for Rural Entrepreneurship, is a gentleman named Don Mackey. Don and I were kind of the primary authors of this original study, and then Don has gone on to do this type of analysis in many, many other places around the country. And then in the context of Nebraska, we've really used it as not just understanding the large macroeconomic opportunity, but there's 93 counties in Nebraska. We actually figured out a methodology for creating an estimate for each and every one of those counties. And then we'll even break it down proportionally to help community leaders begin to think of endowment building within the context of that transfer of wealth. So in, let's say, there's a particular county where the transfer of wealth over the next 50 years is estimated to be $1 billion. So let's just take $1 billion. Part of what we'll talk with community leaders about and help them go through a visioning and action planning process and ultimately a goal-setting exercise associated with endowment building for their place is, what if just 5% of that transfer of wealth were given back to the place where it was made and accumulated? Well, 5% of $1 billion is $50 million. And if that's endowed and you assume that you're going to get a 4 to 4.5% rate of return or a payout from that particular endowment, you know. So 50 times 0.045 is, you know, over $2 million annually that would be a perpetual income stream to benefit that place. Well, we all know the money is important, but at the end of the day, communities made up by people, people being in relationship with one another, people really trusting one another and having a really, you know, opportunistic collective vision about what they can build together. So if you can connect those sorts of relationships with that vision, with that capital, especially if that capital is unrestricted in nature, boy, there's a lot you can get done. And if you think about that philanthropy within the context of how does that philanthropy really serve as a margin of excellence for the future of our place? So assuming that much of what we're already doing will continue doing to help people in need, to provide government services, these sorts of things. And then if you think about that, you know, that endowment being put in place for the future of that particular geography, and then that endowment payout being used to do something above and beyond what we're already doing, that becomes a pretty exciting thing to be a part of. You know, what could we use that on? How can we use that for youth engagement and business development and entrepreneurship? leadership development, intergenerational conversations. I mean, all of these sorts of things that we know help to build the social fabric in our place, and using it to try to build a whole series of new economic opportunities as well. And as John mentioned, we're now doing that work in about 250 communities around the state. And that work looks differently and different in every one of those places. But it's been a really fun journey so far.
Take us to one community and give us a little snapshot of what you might have done to get to trigger the local folks who became engaged in identifying and collecting this wealth.
Yeah.
How do you start that? How does that work?
The first part I start with is that communities can only be built and sustained by the people that live, work, and sleep there. So this is a very decentralized system. Again, we're interested in being somebody's value-added partner. So one of the premises here is that this has to be both community-driven, as well as everything has to be done on kind of a willing partner platform. So to start with, we're interested in working with people that are interested in working with us. So the first thing that would happen is if somebody wanted to create an affiliated fund within the context of the Nebraska Community Foundation, let's take my little hometown of Red Cloud. Red Cloud, for those of you that are fans of American literature, is the home of Willa Cather. So you have this extraordinary cultural asset in Red Cloud, Nebraska, and Red Cloud is about 1,000 people. And it's about 60 miles off the interstate. So it's, a rural agrarian place. It's a fair ways away from, the sort of traditional economic corridor that goes across the state. In the context of Red Cloud, they started an affiliated fund. Those community leaders decided that they wanted that affiliated fund to just concentrate on sort of Red Cloud and kind of the trade area associated with it. So in other places, community leaders may decide we want a community-based affiliated fund that's going to cover a county, or a community-based affiliated fund that's going to cover all of the communities within our school district. Within our system, all of those are locally governed issues and things that can always sort of morph and evolve over time. So in the case of a Red Cloud, they started their affiliated fund. They raised some money for various projects over time. At one point, a resident who had grown up there, we'd been doing this in various other places, so a resident that had grown up there, he was also serving as a member of the Nebraska Community Foundation statewide board of directors, made a challenge grant to help those community leaders begin to build an unrestricted endowment for the future of that community. So that was a $100,000 challenge grant, and that community needed to match that one-to-one. So that got started. About 6 years ago, we helped them go through a really intensive process of vision, mission, and values identification, and really beginning to think through what are the strategic opportunities within this particular community. And of course, in this case, you have this incredible cultural asset. So how would you use heritage tourism as one of the primary drivers for that? So this action planning process ultimately led that fund advisory committee and community leaders to determine they really wanted to concentrate on heritage tourism as an economic development strategy and early childhood education and child care as their sort of two primary pieces. And what I can say is those community leaders have made tremendous progress. There are donors that have stepped up, some in reasonably significant ways, to help some of this come true from a programming standpoint, from a facility standpoint. And all the while, what we're always interested in is how do you engage more and more people within your community, not only in being engaged in that conversation, but ultimately investing their time, talent, treasure within the context of that fund and that community, to help continue to build and evolve that future. So that's a quick story. We've got dozens of those, which is it's really fun to see all the amazing work that's happening.
Jeff, with one, your discovery of the existence of this wealth and the way of framing that's quite amazing. How is this different? Because most every city has a community foundation. What is it you would say is unique about your thinking or your approach to what you're doing?
Yeah, and I think it's always important to talk about all of this stuff is none of this is ever a good or a bad. It's kind
exactly.
of what we've discerned as making the most sense here in our place and our circumstances with our people.
And what's the essence of that?
Yeah, so community foundations are these, you know, these incredible community development tools. I've got wonderful colleagues all over the country that are helping
yeah.
to run and build community foundations, and they all look different. Within the context of Nebraska, I would say there's three things that are very different about the Nebraska Community Foundation. First is the Nebraska Community Foundation itself is not a grant maker. All of our grant making actually happens within the context of affiliated funds. And that's
mm-hmm.
very intentional because ultimately we want community leaders to be very honest with us about what are the opportunities, what are the needs, what are the, you know, what are all the things we need to work on as we partner with these communities to help themselves. So the Nebraska Community Foundation is not a grant maker. We're primarily an educator, a trainer, a facilitator, in some respects almost connecting tissue.
Yeah.
Between all these,
and you
places.
Also manage the money, don't you?
We do. So when you talk about the Nebraska Community Foundation, there's just one corporation. There's about 225 affiliated funds within that one corporation. There's probably 850 or 900 sub funds within those 225 affiliated funds. So there's a very substantial sort of financial and investment management infrastructure that's here. So part of it is understanding that from a community leader, and especially within the context of a small town or a neighborhood, we've all been to those organizing meetings where we're like, we want to get something done. And then the next question becomes, who wants to be treasurer? You know, we're trying to help take some of that burden off of local leaders so they can really focus on mission fulfillment, not just all of the administrative machinations associated with having a nonprofit corporation.
So you basically are the investment manager.
Yeah, we're
and then sort of on an annual basis, whatever growth is, the local group gets its proportionate.
Yeah, it's not quite sure. It's along
but
those lines.
Sort of like that. Yeah.
Sort of
okay.
like that. It's all segregated by fund and by donor intent. And then it's helping those community leaders to really pursue, you know, not only having resources but connecting that resources with vision and engaging members of their community. And what do they want to do next for the future of that place?
You know, I understand. Go ahead. This is Peter. There are some large cities in Nebraska, and or concentrated populations. Have you seen where an affiliated fund would be actually organized around a neighborhood?
We have had a few neighborhood associations be affiliated funds over time, but historically most of our work is within regional trade centers and small communities around the state, as well as we do a fair amount of efforts that are either regional or statewide in scope as well. There's a Lincoln Community Foundation, there's an Omaha Community Foundation. Great people doing great work. They're certainly not organized in the same way the Nebraska Community Foundation is.
I got you.
But lots of, you know, lots of opportunities to work together and support one another in our work. If I might, I wanted to circle back around to that prior question for just a moment in terms of what's the other thing that I think differentiates the Nebraska Community Foundation. And John, this
Please
is something
do.
you've witnessed a couple of years in a row, but we're really we're really vested in peer learning, in helping adults to have experiential learning, but having those community leaders really be in conversation with one another. Just because I'm absolutely of the opinion that people hear something differently from a peer than they do from someone who is, quote unquote, professionalized about their approach to it or being paid for doing that work. So a tremendous amount of our training and education is actually done within the context of peer learning and peer mentoring and an affiliated fund leader from one community helping affiliated fund leaders from a community down the road to understand their story, but to help them work on what's next in their community. In Nebraska,
you said
there's this game out there called 7 Degrees of Separation from Kevin Bacon. You guys heard of that before? In the context of Nebraska, we're only separated by 2 degrees. You know, if you don't know somebody that knows somebody. And a big part of our work is being connected and being in relationship with lots and lots of different people. And the interesting thing about using philanthropy as a community development tool is you can't make anybody do anything. All we can do is motivate and inspire people. But who ultimately is in the best position to do that? And it's people that are already in relationship with one another. So that's much of what we're trying to do, is to help community leaders to be comfortable and confident to talk to their friends and neighbors and people that they have deep trusting relationships with about what's the difference that the person they're talking with could make in the future of their place. And that's, you know, that conversation obviously ranges all over the place. And sometimes it's about making a charitable gift. Sometimes it's about becoming a leader of that fund. Sometimes it's about volunteering their time and talent to help get something done. But it's, John, you've been so articulate over the years about how important invitation is as a part of community building. And we really try to help community leaders understand just how important and profound that invitation is within the community building process.
Give us an example. I don't want to try to force a generalization that isn't there, but if people are listening here may wonder, here we have a town of 1,000 people, and the fund is manifested by the activity of, I don't know, how many people? 4, 5, 6, 20, 50? And how most frequently are those people identified and coalesced?
And you're absolutely right in your sense that it's, you know, we have affiliated funds that have leadership groups. We call them fund advisory committees. Those fund advisory committees might range between 5 community leaders and maybe 20.
Okay.
And in some funds, they'll have a really active and robust sort of subcommittee structure. So the memberships of those subcommittees might then total up to 40 or 50 people, just depending upon the context of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might have, you know, other things happening where literally hundreds of people are a part of helping to build and manifest that. Those groups are, in fact, self-perpetuating groups. Now, some might say, well, that's not the way to do it. Well, what I would say to any of that is, within the context of Nebraska, we found that that's the structure that works best with community building here, is people that are already in relationship with one another and then looking around the table and saying, you know, who else do we need to connect with, or what other opportunities are there? So in some communities, they have entirely local leadership, and in some community-based affiliated funds, there's actually alumni and expatriates that participate as a part of that. It's all one of those things that's kind of, I mean, we're interested in educating and training and sharing effective practice. But ultimately, we're not interested in telling people they have to do it one way or the other. A longtime colleague that has a little quip that says, community building isn't like rocket science. We actually know how to put a man on the moon. You know, we're constantly learning and evolving what we're doing here. One of the things we do know is communities that are doing really, really well within this work are communities that are figuring out how they're engaging dozens and hundreds of their neighbors in conversations about the future of their place and inviting them to be a part of that. So again, it's much of what you've written about and theorized about and practiced over the years in terms of how important that active invitation is.
You also observed the difference between the kind of present-day function of a elected body, the city council, the village board, and the affiliated fund. Could you say a few words about that distinction?
I apologize. Could you repeat the second half of that question, John?
Well, that there is you could think about a local place and it's needing people collectively to get things done, right? A city council is often thought of as this is how we as a group get things done. But the affiliated fund is a group of people getting things done. What's the difference?
I think the difference is a couple things. One is I talked about the fact that in using philanthropy as one of the primary community development tools here, you can't make anybody do anything. So that in and of itself fundamentally differentiates it from government because we're not assessing taxes or fees from anyone. It's all, you know, willing partner, you know, people that are willing to be engaged. The second one is, and this is a generalization, but I think to a large extent government, you know, primarily focuses on now in the very near term. And I would hope that our affiliated funds, especially those that are building endowments for the future of a place, are really more focused on the future, are more focused on, you know, what sort of place do we want to have 10 and 20 years from now as opposed to 3 to 5 years from now? And again, that's a generalization because, I mean, government does do work that has generational impact. We know that through infrastructure and technology and other things. But I think that's one of the key differentiating factors is government is primarily focused on now and the short term. The Nebraska Community Foundation isn't an organization that's really focused on relief. We're an institution that's focused on development. So sometimes, I mean, you'll have a tragic circumstance happen in a place and the people in that place need relief. And we've got lots of incredibly competent partners out there that are really good at that work. So we've decided that that's not our work. You know, our work is to help people really focus on the future and focus on what are the things that help to build and ultimately magnetize this community. So people say, that's where I want to live and work. That's where I want to raise my family. That's where I want to have my business. So those are, you know, within this, we're not, you know, the Nebraska Community Foundation and its affiliated funds, we're not all things to all people. But I'm, you know, and you can obviously speak to this, you've been around this. I think we have done a nice job of helping lots of community leaders focus on the future in ways that they hadn't previously.
And you also, in some of these places, find that the local people engage a significant number of the local citizens in discussions that would result in their joint dialogue and thinking together about the future rather than the four or five or 10 people who are
right.
on the affiliated fund itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, a big part of what we're trying to do is to help people to not only envision but also plan for the future. And a big part of that entire process is figuring out how can we have community-wide conversation about that
mm-hmm.
future and what sort of all of us collectively desire. So in many cases, we'll have a community-wide visioning session. Or we might have several of those. In the community of Norfolk, we help to facilitate 6 of those for constituencies like middle school and high school students, the Chamber of Commerce, nonprofit executives, elders, people that were already investors in that affiliated fund, you know, a variety of different constituencies, you know, just to help sort of start that conversation and then figure out, okay, and how do you connect some of those conversations? Because many times, and we've all seen this, I mean, many times people accidentally end up talking past one another as opposed to with one another. And sometimes within these sessions, we're just helping people to, you know, to make those connections and ultimately to make some more common assumptions than what they had previously.
Peter, you have any?
Well, I want to open it up. We've been going about 30 minutes, but I do have one question.
No,
Jeff. You know, there's a lot of conversation about poverty and wealth inequality, and I'm sure Nebraska is hit by that. How do you think about that? Have you seen the affiliated groups, for example, actually capitalize or start small businesses? I know there's a lot of regional efforts, like you mentioned in your town, have been a heritage tour and try to get more tourist dollars there. But
there's a couple pieces
like
that. Well, let's start with the individual piece in particular. So one of the things we've always tried to look at within the context of Nebraska and the context of especially the out-migration of young people is, okay, what are the things you can do to create greater economic opportunity as well as greater opportunism and optimism about the future?
Right.
So a part of that might be helping to build sort of collective economic development infrastructure. So we've helped to do that in some of the communities and counties where we've worked in to help them amalgamate federal, state, local government dollars along with philanthropic dollars to have economic development professionals. And then how do those economic development professionals really be focused on, okay, what are the things we can do to really, you know, not only increase economic opportunity in this place, but also to change the conversation with young people about mm-hmm. where they want to live and work as adults. So much of our work is around supporting both entrepreneurship curriculum as well as entrepreneurs, connecting that with leadership development and skills development associated with group dynamics, having that conversation in as many ways possible with young people about, you know, where do they want to be and what do they want to be a part of. And then ultimately the philanthropy ends up being sort of the glue that helps hold all of that together over time in comparison to, and, you know, we've all been through the process where you apply for a state or federal grant, you start doing some of that work, but that grant period is 3 years. Well, what happens in year 4?
Exactly.
Well, many times those people end up spending all of their time just sort of trying to sustain the small institution they started as opposed to really getting to concentrate on their mission. The other one that I'll lift up is what we refer to as non-traditional scholarships. So in some of our community-based affiliated funds, they've really identified that one of the most effective ways of helping people that are currently working part-time service sector jobs is to help them return to school, maybe get an associate's degree, maybe get an additional certification, whatever the case might be. So these scholarships are for things like helping an LPN return to school and become a registered nurse, helping a, a high school educated mechanic become a certified diesel mechanic, helping a paraprofessional within the school system become a certified teacher. Opening paths from, you know, part-time service sector work to something that's clearly a member of the middle class. So we've seen a lot of terrific work happen with that, and I think it's also kind of changed the conversation around scholarships in general, around if you're going to invest these community resources in people, how do you invest them so the individual and the community both benefit?
Because a lot of scholarships invested in getting people to go to the university is really an investment in their leaving town.
It really is, and we're not certainly in the business of saying that we shouldn't be sending people off to college. We know that in this economy we need everybody to have more than a high school degree. But that doesn't mean you have to sort of cut off your nose to spite your face. Certainly we can set up scholarships, and we've done dozens of these, whereby preference is given to students who say they're interested in returning to that community or their region after they complete school. Or, you know, how do you just connect those dots? But ultimately, and most importantly within this, it's not about sort of holding somebody to some rules around this. It's the opportunity to have a conversation with them about what they want and how what they want in fact coincides with what is best for the community. It isn't different from that. But it's, you know, how do you begin and sustain that conversation with people about, you're a member of our community, we want you to continue to be a member of our community.
Great focus. Let me interrupt for a second because we want to create some space in case people want to ask questions. Some people are writing in the chat, which I don't know, Jeff, if you can see that or not. But Maggie, you want to invite people to unmute and ask a question or make a comment?
Yes, I'd like to do that. So if you've dialed into TalkShoe into this conversation, you can press *8 on your telephone and you'll be put into a queue. If you're following along on the web, there's a spot where you can post a comment or a question. And Jeff, are you able to see the chat happening?
Yeah, I'm looking through them now.
Okay, great. It sounds like you already answered one of the questions, maybe a couple of the questions there. And we do have a caller. Let's see. I'm going to take guest number 11 who just dialed in.
You invite them to speak?
Yes.
Okay.
So,
that must be me. Can you all hear me?
Yes. Can you tell us your name and where you're from?
Yeah. This is Debbie Johnson. I'm from Austin, Texas. I want to thank Jeff for taking the time and Peter, of course, for setting this up. We've heard, actually, interestingly, a lot of people in Austin have been talking about the Nebraska effort, which is what prompted me to dial in. And I thank Jeff for giving us a little more context and information about and background on how you went about your study and what it's meant to you all, because I know here we have a new head to the Community Foundation who is trying some new and innovative things, and so potentially we'll be following in your footsteps. I just have a totally personal indulgence here. When I saw your picture, you look an awful lot like Jay Yost. Are you related?
Yeah, he's my brother.
I went to school with Jay, and in fact, we were in mortarboard and some other things together.
Oh, hilarious.
So.
Well,
when are you
moving back to Nebraska?
Pardon?
When are you moving home to Nebraska?
Don't count on it. Not from Austin.
But
anyway,
you're from Austin, but you came to the University of Nebraska?
Yeah, I'm actually not from Texas. I'm from Lincoln originally, went to the university there. And my husband's a golfer, so enough said why I'm in Austin.
Very good.
So anyway, tell Jay hello. It's been a long time. It was Debbie Schmidt was my maiden name. So.
No, I will do so. Thank you
I'm
for making that connection. And it's a perfect anecdote of the 2 degrees of separation piece. Yeah.
It really is.
Thanks, Debbie.
Yep.
Thank
Kathy,
you.
Kathy, anybody else in line? Maggie?
So, yes, we do. see. This is Ontario. Hello?
Oh, hi. Yes, it's Michelle Strutzenberger calling. I'm from Peterborough, Ontario. Thanks as well for hosting this, Peter and John, the conversation with Jeff. I just have a question. I see that the Democracy Collaborative in Ohio recently released a report on innovative community foundations. They shared the stories of 29 U.S. and one Canadian foundation. And one element they mentioned was a growing exploration of something called impact investing by these foundations. So you mentioned that the Nebraska Foundation itself is not a grant maker, but it's 225 affiliated funds are.
Mm-hmm.
What possibilities do you see for these funds engaging in this sort of impact investing or social finance type work?
So by impact investing, are you related to are you connecting it to things like mission related investment and program related investments? Or is this just more
yes,
of
the... There is an expectation of both a financial and a social return. So there's that sort of blended ROI.
I mean, certainly the point of having any of these resources is to be able to help people create community impact in their place. I'm a big believer that when you've seen one community, you've seen one community. And making sure. Generalizations around what is a good investment and what is not can be a really dicey proposition. So it's part of why we really try to focus on how do you connect the grant making with, you know, the process of engaging lots and lots of people, of building that collective vision, going through a planning process, creating priorities, because we know we're not going to have enough resources or enough leadership or enough time to be able to do all of these things at once. But part of what I think you're working on within that process of engaging people and continuing to sort of funnel down toward, you know, moving from lots and lots of things being important to a few things being priorities is the opportunity to see something change. The connecting piece to that I'll make is I would, you know, hopeful that many of you are familiar with the concept of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Over time, I've become a big believer that a community has a self-fulfilling prophecy just like an individual does. And how does all of this, all of these process things that we're discussing today, how do you help that community to really identify where they're at as it relates to their self-concept and their self-fulfilling prophecy, and how do you help them continue to, you know, to continue to discern how to make that better and how to make that more optimistic? And certainly grant making can be a key tool within the context of that. The final thing I'll say on this question is I think sometimes within the concept of when we have this intersection between community and philanthropy, we end up putting too much emphasis on philanthropy and not enough emphasis on community. I mean, the thing that I think I've become very comfortable saying over time is money's an important tool, but it's only one of many tools required to do good community building. And at the end of the day, and the transfer of wealth was all in, the transfer of wealth studies were all intended to help make this point. The limiting resource here isn't money. We're an extraordinarily wealthy country. We're an extraordinarily wealthy society. We can pretty much choose to do whatever we choose to do. So the question is, how do you choose to, you know, to focus on community building and creating opportunity and creating more just outcomes for more people. So to me, this is more of a function of leadership and more of a function of vision and more of a function of engagement than it is a function of capital. They're all important, but within the context of community building, I'm convinced that money is not the limiting resource to us getting things done. It's going to be lots of other pieces, and if the vision and the leadership and the engagement are in place, I've now got years and years of evidence that we can figure out how to access the money to help get that done. I probably didn't take that on directly, and so if that wasn't responsive enough, I'd be happy to have a conversation about that offline.
And I think the question is that you see a lot of people like venture capitalists and people like that really turning things upside down in alignment with what you're talking about, Jeff, and saying we're going to invest, but the question of return is secondary or third. Where we want to invest is in new ventures that, you know, have a social justice component or social impact. And the impact investing in something called SoCal.
Right.
It's not just the community foundation philanthropy. It's also, you know, local people with all the same goals you have of keeping kids here and building a place and changing the criteria for what constitutes a good investment. And,
right.
You're thinking about that's really aligned with that very much. Maggie, anybody else calling in? I want to.
No one else is calling in.
There's a couple notes here on the couple questions that people have asked that I think might be interesting to connect to, if that's.
Please.
If that's okay.
We've got about five.
Sure.
Yeah, please.
There is one here around. Is Mac Johnson on the phone?
Yeah.
His note here is see a good related resource for trust-oriented grassroots relational organizing, the Network Weaver Handbook. And I would like to state that I think he's absolutely correct. A woman named June Holly from Athens, Ohio, has created network weaving. And I find it to be extraordinarily useful work. And she's been working on this for a couple decades and doing terrific work. And I'm actually having a series of conversations with John and Tom Moskaller and others around how do we connect network weaving and asset mapping within the context of a particular place and helping them to not only, you know, fully articulate that vision and move that from plan to opportunity, but also how do you use this to be an even greater connection with all of these people that care and are willing to step up and lead and support? So there's a link that Mac put in here to the Network Weaver stuff, and I would heartily endorse that good work as another piece of building out this ecosystem.
Any other questions there that you want to respond to?
I like the one, and I'd be interested in John and Tom, the two of you, maybe talking about this a little bit, but local people are being witnessed by you as they assume dominion over their inner and external resources, a huge discovery of personal power.
Somebody is saying that.
Mm-hmm. Guest number
sounds
eight,
right.
Wrote Peter. I don't know what Peter's last name is. Peter K.
Peter Kestenbaum. He's a friend of ours.
Oh.
I just think that's a really important statement within the context of this work over time. Is it's never about the money. It's always about the people and helping people to have confidence and feeling like their work is. Important and honorable, and they're difference makers.
I think what part of the work you're doing, Jeff, is helping people come to terms with wealth, and you could call it the right use of wealth. You know, in this consumer society, a surplus society, accumulation society, most of us are out of relationship with money, either whether you're poor or whether you're rich, and I think you're trying to bring us into a right relationship with wealth and recognize it's useful, but it's not the point. And most people say that, especially at the end of their lives, but I think you really embody that with the work that you're doing and the thinking, the facilitation that you bring. It's really quite amazing.
Well, that's really great. That's really gracious of you to say. Thank you very much. And and all that credit goes to all of these amazing people here in Nebraska. I mean, there's now 1,800 volunteers that are serving as affiliated fund leaders for these these various community-based efforts, and it really has become a pretty sizable movement in terms of the number of people and the number of moving parts, and it's
Jeff, if people want to follow up on this discussion, can you tell us your website and anything else that might
so
be accessible?
Our website is, and I can assume I could just write this in here as well, so I will do that here in just a moment. But our website is nebcommfound.org, or you can obviously just Google Nebraska Community Foundation. That'll take you to our homepage. And I'm certainly happy to have offline conversations with those of you that are interested in following up on some of this, whether it be around how do we use the transfer of wealth or how we've tried to figure out this very decentralized system, because it is a work in progress. And I think that's the fun, is every day we're building something and helping to be a partner in creating an opportunity or solving a problem or whatever the case might be. And it feels good to have the opportunity to wake up to this every morning.
Okay.
You know, I also had the thought that you call them volunteers, but what you're really doing is creating citizens. And because they're co-producing something, they're not just, because most volunteers for someone else's sake, and there's a co-production, co-creation in every the way you talk about it. It's really what citizenship is about. So thank you for that also.
Oh, thank you.
So I think we're pretty near the end. John, any final words you have?
Makes me think over and over again that when you think about money as wealth, what we're learning here is that if you really are concerned about community, it isn't about grants. Money is the bait, not the fish. And what's going on here is a wonderful recognition that always keeping the relational aspect of community at the forefront is critical. And how do we use money in such a way that it's a precipitant of wisdom and more intentional community life? Because we all know that there are places, often lower income places, that have become grants economies. And there you can actually finally, in the philanthropic and government world, can lead people to think you can't do anything without a grant. So grants go two ways. They can either be wonderful precipitants, or they can be disabling in the long run. And what we're hearing here is the way to think about wealth as a real community builder. It's a wonderful thing you've done, Jeff.
Like I said, it's hundreds and hundreds of people focusing on this, and it's an honor to be a part of it. So thank you, John. John's been a wonderful inspiration and additional content provider to us here in Nebraska the last couple of years. And John, I just want to thank you for doing all that.
It's great to learn from you.
Helps everybody charge their batteries, and I think that's always an important part of this.
Good.
All right, thank you very much, Jeff and John. You now have a new job title, battery charger. Very true. So, Maggie, do you want to complete this?
Sure. Well, first off, Jeff, I'd like to thank you for a couple of reminders to me. And one was, it's always about the people, and that we do have abundance. Sometimes we forget those things. So thank you again for taking the time to be with us today. Jeff has posted online the website, nebcommfound.org, and you can reach him through that website. And we'd like you to join us next time, which is going to be April 7th. And soon we'll be posting the schedule for the year on our website, which is www.abundantcommunity.com. So please do stay in touch with us. this brings our program to a close today, and thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Maggie.
Thanks.
Thank you, Maggie.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thank you
Take
all.
Care.